The Money Cafe is brought to you by Eureka Report, your one-stop shop for all things finance. To sign up for your free 15-day trial, head to eurekareport.com.au. Now it's time to enjoy today's episode.
Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, finance presenter on ABC News and columnist for The New Daily.
And I'm James Thompson, senior Chanticleer columnist at the Australian Financial Review.
And we are The Money Cafe. G'day, James. Now, listen, good piece this morning about office property or REITs in general.
Thank
and
you.
The valuations of office properties are falling.
Yes.
Because I had a graph on the news the other night. It's all because of my graph on the news the other night. No. Now, the graph of office rental vacancies is up to close to 15%, which is the highest in 30 years since the last recession.
Mm.
So that's obviously affecting valuations. And what you're talking about is the fact that the landlords are coming up against their debt covenants.
Yeah, well,
explain what you mean.
So when a real estate investment trust borrows plenty of money, and their gearing, their debt levels generally have to stay below a certain level as required by the banks. So the gearing level that's
debt versus the actual asset value.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So. The gearing level that the most debt covenants have is around 50%. And so we had yesterday Charter Hall Long Whale REIT, which is one of the Charter Hall REITs. It's got all sorts of stuff in it, logistics sheds, retail, some office. So their look-through gearing is 42.3%, and it ticked up a bit because the value of their properties went down during
the office properties.
Yeah, all properties.
All of them.
All right. Of their properties went down 360-odd million, about 5%. But the office properties fell hardest. They were down 9% over the course of the year. So the problem is if you keep getting the valuations falling, you start to get near this point. You start to breach or potentially breach these debt covenants. Now, Charter Hall Long Whale REIT quite rightly says we've got lots of room. 42% gearing, we're a long way from 50%, and we're planning to sell some assets and pay down some debt. But the problem is that as you sell these assets, you're selling them into a weak market. And so that sort of crystallizes or locks in the fall in valuations. And then you get this sort of vicious cycle, I guess, where you're trying to outrun your debt covenants and outrun falling asset prices.
Are there many investors like this who only own office property?
Yeah, Dexus and Charter Hall are the most leveraged to office property. So Dexus would be, which is a listed REIT again, is primarily office property. So, and what these guys are saying is not all office property is created equal, which you can sort of understand if you think of a suburban office block. That's going to be worth a certain amount of money, and a brand new spanking tower in the city, well, that should be worth more money because it's brand new spanking tower in the city that everyone wants to move into.
Suburban office block is almost like working from home.
Oh, well, not quite. I don't know if you've been to many suburban office blocks. It's not quite.
Are they hollowing out more than the city ones, are they?
Well, I'm not sure if they're hollowing out, but the A-grade property values, the top-grade property values, are holding up the best. And so as you get lower down the office scale, that's where...
How often are they required to value these things?
Yeah, that's a good question. So they put a valuation out every 6 months with their semi-annual report or the semi-annual results. Independent valuations needs to be done once a year. So you do have this thing where some buildings are valued by independent people and some buildings are valued by... non-independent, you know, basically
themselves.
So
where do you think working from home is going to settle?
I really don't know.
How often do you work from home?
Oh, well, last week it wasn't at all. This week I think it's going to be one day today,
right?
So but I don't know, am I abnormal normal? I
think you're totally abnormal, yeah.
From what I can see based on my parking at the train station, Mondays and Fridays are quiet, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays are pretty busy. So I guess that's where it's going to settle for the foreseeable future.
I reckon it'll settle at 3 days a week, yeah, maybe on average. Three days of working from home or 3 days in the office, I'm not sure.
What's interesting to me is that you're starting to see it enshrined in the workplace agreements of some of the big banks, for example. They've got, you know, clauses around this stuff now. So it's not going away soon.
The only way these companies can handle working from home really is by hot desking, right? Because you can't expect if you work from home 2 or 3 days a week, you can't really expect to have your own desk on the other 2 or 3 days.
Yes. So this is the interesting thing if you're an office property landlord. Now, someone of your high esteem would expect to have their own desk, I'd imagine. So
yeah, but I don't. Well, the only office I work in is the ABC.
Yep.
And when I go in there, it's hot desking. But everyone at the ABC hot desks.
Well, there you go. And that's probably the solution. But there'll be a lot of people who want the best of both worlds. I want to work from home when I want, and I want my own desk. So if you're a corporate, how do you manage that? You don't really need the same amount of space as you once did, but how do you reduce it? And you're right, hot desking's probably the answer.
Yeah. So, but which is going to lead to a permanent reduction in office space requirements.
Yes.
Which means that a lot of office space just isn't going to be required.
I think that's right. And then you get back to that thing. So do people go to the best offices rather than going to the...
Oh, I see. Yeah, sure.
Or do people, you know... If you're struggling to get people in, you probably want to provide them with the best office possible to encourage them to get in. And so that crappy suburban office or that crappy cheap office in the city, not going
to
work.
Well, I was talking to a CBD restaurateur yesterday. I don't go into the CBD much anymore, but I was talking to this guy I've known for a long time who runs a restaurant, and he saying that their business is definitely down,
yep,
permanently. Like, it's not just a slump. It's serious. It's long-term serious down reduction in business.
And you walk around the city, and that is who I feel sorry for. The businesses that were a vibrant part of the city, the little lunch spots, some of them that you walk past and you think, you know, 3 years ago that place had a queue out the door every single day and now it is gone. Like, you do feel...
So what's happened to these people? For them, this is just like these are little family businesses, yeah, usually, and what's happened is they've taken a pay cut.
Yes, they've taken a pay cut. Or presumably, based on the employment stats, they got a job, a different, you know, a paid job. They're no longer running their own business.
They've given up. But those who haven't given up have just got less income.
Yeah, basically. And so they would be employing less staff and working less hours. You know, there was a good article, I think, is in The Age recently about how hard it is to get a coffee in Melbourne after 3 o'clock because everyone shuts after the lunch.
Yeah.
Rush. Such is the lunch rush is.
Just on today, you've got CBA this morning. Have you been looking at their presentation?
Very quickly, yes. $10.6 billion cash profit.
For how? What period?
For the full year, ended June 30. Dividend up 17%. I think the big thing that everyone will focus on is the margin. It's down 5 basis points from the half year. So this has been the story of the banks. Their margins peaked in late 2022 and they have continued to fall as both mortgages have remained competitive and it's got a lot more competitive on deposits. I think the interesting thing for me, Alan, is right up the front of the CBA presentation, they make the point that, okay, banks win from higher interest rates, but we're helping everyone else too. So the amount of interest they've received from mortgages and other borrowers, $15.7 billion. The amount of interest they've paid out to depositors and other wholesale funding providers, $16.5 billion. So they're saying, hey, swings and roundabouts for us too. We're just good banks.
But is that
doing it tough?
Do you think or know whether that's unusual? That's different to what it usually is?
That's a good question. Well, it would be different to what it's been because deposit rates were pretty crappy until relatively recently. So this has been the thing that's plumped up their profits in recent years. I guess CBA is making the point, hey, that's rolling back now.
Well, so they're having to pay more for deposits.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, everyone's been saying that they haven't been passing it on.
Well, that's right. That's I guess this is them trying to get ahead, get ahead of any blowback from the ACCC's deposit inquiry, maybe.
Yeah. Have you been watching the Matildas?
Oh, how good is it? I went last week and it was just it's one of those things when they it's just such a relief when they score, to be frank. You know, because they're
none of these they don't score very often in soccer.
They don't. It's not like footy, but and I don't know if you sort of I'm not a massive soccer expert by any stretch of the imagination, but the Matildas play, they don't like having the ball. They like the other team having the ball and scoring on the counter-attack. So it gets a bit nervy because the other team's got the ball a lot. And yeah, it's all part of the plan, but until they get a couple of goals, it's hard to relax.
So I watched Media Watch the other night and they were talking about, Paul Barry was talking about how Optus Sport picked up the rights to the Women's World Cup ages ago for $8 million, right? Which was, you know, a bargain, clearly. Yeah. And then they decided that everyone would be very mad at them if they hogged them, so they gave 15 games to Channel 7.
Yeah.
And that's how come we're watching it, because none of us are subscribers to Optus Sport.
Well...
Or are you?
No, I'm not, I must confess, but I think Optus Sport has gone with a big soccer strategy in their streaming service. They own the rights to the English Premier League. They got those from Foxtel about 5 years ago, I guess. Very controversially. Everyone loved it on Foxtel. Everyone hated it initially on Optus Sport because there were problems with the streaming service.
And it's expensive. It's $25 a month.
Yeah, but, this is the thing, Alan. Everyone had a crack at these streaming services. People, as the cost of living crisis has hit, you know, we see from the numbers in the US, some of the streamers are struggling a bit. So it'll be interesting to see whether this is a gold mine for Optus or something else. I think Optus is pretty excited about how this has gone.
I must say, I think that it'll possibly change everything for women's sport and broadcast rights and money going to women's sport. The ratings on Seven have been extraordinary.
Yeah.
So... You wonder, I mean, everyone's kind of going, oh, hang on, it's actually good to watch.
Yeah, well, I think it always was.
Of course, but it's starting to, you know, when you get 4 million.
Home World Cup, it's, you know.
Sure.
It's great. I mean, there's always something about when everyone's barracking for the same team, which rarely happens in footy and stuff, so good on them. Yeah. Keep going.
You had an interesting piece, just before we get on to questions, you had an interesting piece on Zimmerman the other day. They were being sold.
Yeah, amazing story.
Yeah, tell us about Zimmerman.
Zimmerman is a women's fashion label, ready-to-wear fashion, a resort wear, Alan, and swimwear.
What does that mean?
Resort wear is stuff you wear on around the resorts.
At resorts.
Your caftan and that, I think. I'm way out of my depth here. But what's really interesting, started by Nikki and Simone Zimmerman, two sisters, started selling at Paddington Markets in the early 90s, and they just sold this thing to a US private equity group for $1.75 billion. Does about 125 in EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortization every year. And it's a legitimate luxury brand. I mean, it's been sold on 14 times earnings, which is right up there for even luxury brands. And this is a business run out of Sydney.
Is it online mainly?
No. They've got 58 standalone stores around the world, mostly in... I mean, it's very expensive stuff, so they're mostly in high-end places. But it's a great... I mean, this is the second big luxury brand sale. You'd probably know that the sort of fancy hand wash and cosmetics brands, Aesop.
Yeah.
That's a Melbourne-born brand, still headquartered here. That sold earlier this year to L'Oreal for $2.75 billion. I mean, we are quietly creating these global brands out of Australia that are...
And then flogging them.
Well...
Fair enough.
No, but I mean, this is the thing. It is the recognition of the potential growth of these brands by foreign investors that's getting them over. Like, there's no Australian private equity firms grabbing these things and taking them global. It's US and European private equity firms who are recognising the value here and saying, this is not an Australian brand, it's a global brand.
Yeah, well, same thing happened with RM Williams, didn't it?
Yeah, well, yes. Although, yes, that was bought by LVMH's private equity firm and then bought back by Andrew Forrest.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I think it's under Forrest's ownership that that thing's taken off. From what I can gather, LVMH didn't do a great job. Right. And now Forrest has really souped the place up. And a pair of RM Williams is ridiculously expensive these days. You don't get much change out of $700. But they've done a really good job of growing sales and getting overseas. So it can be done from Australia. It's interesting.
I just put in a word at this point for Rossi boots.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's your pick?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So.
Adelaide business.
Yeah. Yeah, well, do we have a sponsorship with them, Alan? Can we get a couple of pairs? Or
I think we should now.
Yeah, right.
I gave Virginia Trioli last week doing an interview. Was it last week or the week before? Anyway, I gave Daryl's Peanut Butter a big plug.
Right. I'm not familiar with Daryl's Peanut Butter.
Well, you should be.
No, I don't like peanut butter.
You don't like peanut butter?
Yeah. No.
I'm shocked.
No good.
Okay. Well, it's no good talking to you about it. just before we go into questions, I just wanted to give a plug not only to Daryl's Peanut Butter, but to Eureka Report's subscriptions.
Right.
And we should, it's a good subscription.
Go Eureka Report.
Ethan says, in your most recent episode, Alan and Stephen both mentioned an ABS statistic suggesting that 10% of homes were vacant, but that figure is deeply misleading. Most of these homes simply had no one home on the night of the census, were on the market or getting renovated or demolished. Not to mention a high proportion of legitimately vacant homes that are in regional areas and not in the metropolitan areas where people want to live. SGS estimated the actual figure would be two-thirds the size.
Okay. Can we take that as a comment?
We can. I
think Ethan makes a reasonable point. Given how low the rental vacancy rate is, you would think 10% does sound a bit ambitious to me. I don't know.
I mean, it's clearly true that a lot of houses are vacant. I mean, this is driving a lot of people crazy. We've got a land rental vacancy rate of whatever it is, 1.2%. But there's a lot of vacant homes.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people have got a second home as a beach house. So,
sure.
You know.
Sure. Yeah.
What are you going to do about that? You're going to ban them?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I did see something on Twitter the other day saying, the best thing you could do to reduce your carbon emissions was not have a second home. But I thought that was interesting.
Now, I left this next question. This next question is way too long from Tim.
Yes.
Tim, it's too long. Come on.
But, come on, man.
I left it there because of his stuff on Airbnb.
Okay. Do you want to extract it for us?
I'm trying to. I should have done it earlier. You've quoted a few times, the premiums in Airbnbs being significantly higher than long-term leases. Sorry, but I'm not sure where you got this data from, but it's not correct. We advise clients on looking at both options, and the rough rule of thumb is that in Airbnb you need to be able to generate twice the gross income, excluding cleaning revenue, to broadly come out square with a long-term lease. The vast majority of properties do not get close to the basic metric of being able to produce double gross income on short term.
Right.
My personal experience in doing this analysis for clients is that about 5% of properties pass that test. A lot of people forget that many people choose short term over long term, not for financial gain, but simply for lifestyle reasons. Okay, your turn.
Jonathan writes, you, Dr. Lowe, Albo, and the rest of the country can thank me. In the middle of June, I rented out my home and moved into my parents, then overseas. The RBA has seen the drop in demand in the economy and decided to leave rates on hold twice. This has saved the country from crippling high interest rates and an economic life-destroying depression. You're welcome. Thank you, Jonathan. He did the thing that Dr. Lowe suggested, that we all need to move back in with our parents or...
move overseas. That'd reduce demand.
Yeah.
He's gone overseas, so that's fine. Yeah.
Well, I don't think I've seen you since the RBA's decision last week. Were you, you probably covered this last week, but were you pleased to see they stayed on hold?
Yep. I think they'll continue to stay on hold.
You think that's it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I hate to skite, but... But I will. I said in June that that's it.
Yep, you did.
And there was a hold in July and a hold in August.
Can I ask the next question? When do you think the cut comes?
I think we'll be at 4.1% for pick a number 2 years.
Oh, okay, yep. My prediction is February 2025 is when we might get the first cut.
But why would they cut?
Well, because the economy might be slowing down and the inflation's tamed. No need to hold rates so high if there's no inflation.
Rates aren't high, that's the point. The point is that rates are... This 4.1%, I actually went back and loaded all of the cash rates over the past 30 years into a spreadsheet.
Yep.
And found that the average cash rate over the past 30 years is 4.1%.
Yeah, but what's the average inflation?
Yeah, well, I don't know. But the point is that this is 4.1% is pretty normal.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the average over 30 years, should it be the average over 10 or 50 years? I don't know. But 4.1% is normal.
Yep.
It was 1.5% the cash rate for almost 3 years between 2015 and 2018.
Yeah, yeah.
And was 1.5% normal? Definitely not. That was abnormal.
I take your point, but I think the vast majority of property owners would not see 4.1% as normal. Given that, you know, the loan books turn over every 6 years about. So that's going to... 4.1% for 2 years will take some serious adjusting in the mortgage belt of Australia. Serious adjustment.
The problem is that the RBA and central banks everywhere really made a big mistake in trying to pursue their target of 2 to 3%. When inflation was at 1.5. So the reason that rates were... The reason the cash rate was cut below 2% back in 2015 was because inflation was below 2%.
And they were trying to spike it.
And so for 7 years? No, 8, 9 years, rates were below what they ought to be as the Reserve Bank was trying to get inflation up to 2%.
Yeah.
And that got people... people overborrowed.
Yeah.
So we've got this huge increase in household debt, huge increase in house prices. It was an appalling mistake, I don't think they can actually that can influence future behaviour. I mean, I think that so the reason, as you say, it's going to take difficulty getting used to 4.1% cash rate, and the mortgage rate that goes with that is because people borrowed so much.
Yeah, but that's why the rates could be cut, because the economy buckles under 4.1%. An extended period of 4.1%. There's so much debt in the household sector.
I think that's an interesting point. Question of whether the Reserve Bank does respond to that, or whether they hold out and say that everyone's got to adjust the debt.
Yeah.
So what's going to have to happen is that, you know, debt's adjusted.
Yeah. Well,
in some way, I don't know how.
But again, that's really interesting, because Phil Lowe basically got the chop for raising rates. Is Michelle Bullock going to get a pat on the back for keeping them at 4.1% for the next 2 years?
Of course. She will take the credit for getting inflation down without a recession, right? I mean...
Yeah, but what you're saying is that central banks need to normalise rates...
I'm saying they have.
Yep, they have normalised rates. Now but if they don't hold them there, the rates aren't normalised.
Oh, I see, sure. Yeah. So, yeah, look, it is a question of what is normal now?
Yeah.
Is normal 4.1% and 5% in the US? I don't know.
It's going to be fascinating.
Maybe there's a new normal because of high debt.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a fair point.
We have digressed. I apologise.
That's all right. No, it's good. Because we haven't got many questions, and anyway... I think we can skip Diane. Diane's talking about photosynthesis, and it's not really a question, so sorry, Diane. Alan, just listen to this week's... Oh, another bloody Airbnb question.
Yes.
Just listen to this week's podcast and the tacit endorsement of the Airbnb model. My question is, why should Airbnb property owners be allowed to deduct 100% of expenses when the properties are not let for 100% of the time, in contrast to seasonal holiday homes which have their expenses prorated on a day's let basis? I think the difference, Alan, is what's the proportion that they're available to rent. Holiday houses are often just not available to rent when the owner wants to be there.
Yes.
And Airbnbs are available to rent all the time, I would
say. I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the difference.
Yeah. Alan does make a point that that's...
No, it's a fair point, but yeah. But what the Airbnb owner's accountant's going to ask is how long, what period is it available to rent? Because that's the period that matters.
Good point. Joanna says, I'm a great fan of yours. Your analysis of the inflation from January onwards was amazing. Oh, I think
well done, James. Well done.
That's yours, Alan. She says, the RBA must have listened to you and held off interest rates at the last two meetings. How do you think the big four banks will perform in the second half of this year and next year?
That's a question for you, James.
Okay. I think the big four banks are in for a... Look, they're going to be fine, totally fine, but they're in for a more difficult 18 months than they've seen for a little while. We've got competition in mortgages still intense. Competition in deposits will increase, and so the pressure on their margins is building. And then you've got the potential that their bad and doubtful debts will tick up. Now, just looking at CBA's numbers this morning, their bad and doubtful debts are still at historic lows. So there's nothing really to worry about. But as we've just been talking about, the period of adjustment when more people get onto these higher interest rates after low fixed rates and the RBA's hikes come through, there's still about a quarter of those hikes to come through to people's monthly mortgage payments. That's going to be the testing stuff. So it's going to be a bit tougher for them over the next 18 months, for sure.
Is it just me or they turned up the music in this place? Honestly, it's...
Bit of ACDC gets a
hundred. Is that ACDC?
Yeah, Back in Black.
God. Final question from Rex. May I ask you a question about monetary policy? Yes, you may, Rex. Following the Reserve Bank raising interest rate 12 times at its past 15 meetings, a number of observers have argued that raising rates is the only weapon in the RBA's anti-inflation arsenal. That is not true, I believe. What about quantitative tightening as opposed to easing? That is, the RBA could be selling from its large holdings of Australian government bonds, but probably making capital losses along the way. I don't know to what extent they've been doing this. There are other tools for fighting inflation, such as direct intervention in foreign exchange markets, although the RBA would be reluctant to do that, I think. Not to mention the various forms of prudential regulation of the banks, which is not a Reserve Bank of responsibility. The point is that raising interest rates is not the only shot the RBA has in the locker. Do you agree? Yes, of course. But the RBA, what the RBA is doing at the moment is not selling bonds. They're just letting them mature.
Yeah.
So they're reducing their... They are reducing their bond holdings, but they're not selling them. I think the Fed is engaged in quantitative tightening.
It is, yep.
And it's selling bonds.
It is, yep.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure why the RBA is not doing that, but it's obviously decided it doesn't need to.
Don't think its balance sheet's quite as big as the Fed's got.
No.
As in, the quantitative easing was nowhere near as big as what the Fed and other central banks have done. So there's probably not as much to quantitatively tighten.
I mean, it is true that the RBA is basically insolvent because of all the bonds they bought, which have all gone down in value enormously, and it's got... I can't remember. I did look at the balance sheet a few weeks ago, and they've got something like $550 billion worth of bonds that have gone down in value, and their capital, their total capital, is $40
million. Okay. Yep. Right.
So, I mean, they are an inverted pyramid sitting on a point.
Yes. Yes. I think Rex, the answer is that is. Quantitative tightening is a theoretical weapon, but it's more like, compared to interest rates, it's like a stick compared to a missile. It's just not big enough to move the dial in the way that interest rates are.
Yeah. Well, because it doesn't directly affect households in the same way, obviously. Well, there you are. Thanks for listening, everyone, to today's episode of Money Cafe. It's been great, as usual, even despite AC/DC in the background.
Some listeners might decide it's the best part of the podcast, Alan.
I'm sure they will. It'll be Stephen May next week. So if you've got a question for us, send it to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Until then, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report.
And I'm James Thompson, senior Chanticleer columnist at the Australian Financial Review.
See you next week.